It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora, and welcome to Bookends with me, Marianne Stone, in the studio all on my own to record our intro, although you do get plenty of Morin in the show. It's exciting to be on my own, all allowed the access to the tools. So I've made up my own order. We're starting with Claudia from Scorpio. Claudia gives us a whistle-stop tour through all of the books that are flying off the shelves at Scorpio this month, and some great insight and beautiful descriptions of those stories. So really well worth a listen if you're wondering, hunting for your next read. And that's not just limited to NZ Lit. So it's the one time where we look beyond our shores and get a couple of insights into international lit. Then we move on to New Zealand new releases, and we've got Morin talking with about a book that's pretty close to her heart, actually. It's a book about an architect, Claude Megson, and Morin interviews the author, Jackie Mayring, and I'll let Morin tell you in that interview about why that book matters for her. And then we close with a beautiful new book of poetry, Pepeha Portal, and that's by Ariana Tikau, and we get a lovely reading with that as well. So a wonderful show full of all sorts of eclectic, odd mix, but that's what you get if you're looking at Aotearoa literature, lots of marvellous. Thanks for listening. It's time this week for another session with our fabulous sponsors, Scorpio Books, and their marvellous and effervescent Claudia, who manages both our staff picks and our upcoming event sessions for us at the moment. So, Claudia, this week I think we're talking about staff picks, the best books from Scorpio.
That's right. What's hot on the shelves, what's been selling well, and just know there are plenty more books I'd love to tell you about, but we've sold out of them because such loyal customers with such good noses. Before I even get to the radio segment, I have to toss out half my notes.
Oh my God. Well, that's a good problem to have, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yeah. I'll get through. So in terms of New Zealand fiction, last month's bestsellers and this month's bestsellers look pretty similar, but the highlight titles for us, I'll start with Song of the Saltings by Rachel King, which just came out on the 28th of April. This is marketed as YA fiction, but having listened to her read a section of the introduction at the launch the other night, I think adults shouldn't be put off, because if you love a sort of folky gothic horror, but maybe without the kind of ostentatious, sort of gore and frightfulness of adult horror, you're probably going to love this book. I would kind of describe it like it's got the atmosphere of Hagstone by Sinead Gleeson, which came out a couple of years ago. And that was like quite a big hit. And I really loved Hagstone. I thought it was really fun. It's got that atmosphere, but then the plot is a bit more kind of like an adventure novel. So there's sort of a distant past, and then the characters in the present. There's a sort of overbearing council of elders who need to be brought down a peg or two. Rachel highlighted that she leaned quite heavily on the vibe of the Dark is Rising sequence by Cooper, which I also love. So look out for that one, Song of Saltings, Song of the Saltings.
Saltings then, not Saltans. It's an interesting, concept, the Saltings. So, Song of the Saltings, Rachel King.
That's right. The first few times I looked at it, I kept on scrambling the letters in my head and making it singular or slatting or something like that. I don't know, some mild form of dyslexia going on there for me in my brain, but that's the one. And then other New Zealand fiction that we'd like to make note of this month, Banjara by Shana Chandra, which is a Moa Press publication. Shana did do an author talk just last week. It came in quite late, so we didn't get it into our event segment. This book is, it's sort of two narratives happening, being sort of intertwined. So you'll swap back and forth between sort of contemporary and the past. The narrative set in the past is about indentured labourers who are Indian, who are taken to Fiji and forced to work. And then in the contemporary narrative, you have one of their, what's the opposite of ancestor, you know, descendants. You have one of their descendants kind of making sense of the family's past in this modern world and looking for answers, kind of trying to figure out why and how. So the narrative has been, like, the response we had at the event in the shop was that a lot of people have families who have experienced similar things from that part of the world. So it's clearly touched on like a potent nerve, and people want to talk about this. And I think a lot of readers in contemporary Aotearoa might not necessarily know about the history of Fiji and indentured labour. So that's a really interesting book that's picking up steam. I think keep an eye on that one.
Give us the title and author again, Claudia.
That book was Banjara by Shana Chandra. Shana Chandra is quite... if you have a look online, she's got a great website, and she's quite well known as a fashion and art writer. But this is her first foray that I'm aware of into publishing fiction.
These multi-talented people across Aotearoa, they make me feel kind of anxious. My goodness. Anywho, so, and moving on.
I hope it's the start of a big career for Shana. If you just need some classic historical fiction for your wintry reads, we have Lauren Keenan's latest book, The Other Catherine, described as, you know, successful commercial historical fiction. And also The End and the Beginning by K.J. Holden, which is about a family in just on the edge of Germany in World War II who can't seem to get themselves on the right side of the war.
They're so sort of, both, you know, both of those ones, The End and the Beginning and Other Catherine, we've recently interviewed on Bookend, so they'll both be available to air as well for anybody interested in those titles. And both great, great historical novels, one about the war and one about New Zealand's kind of colonial past.
We're hearing good things all around. And then moving into international fiction, you won't be surprised. There's a new Jan Martel book out, Son of a Nobody, and we're pretty much sold out. So there's more coming, but for those of you out there who love Life of Pi, and also for people who love epic poetry, what he's done with this book is quite interesting. It's laid out a bit like it's sort of left aligned. It's laid out like an epic poem with kind of like footnotes beneath it. And the story, I understand, focuses on a classicist kind of dealing with, working on ancient literature and kind of puzzling away at some sort of dramas while he does so. So that's a big one for us. And also our next book of the month is Crux by Gabriel Talent, which is about two young boulderers and rock climbers who have sort of, they're friends, but they're kind of dealing with a world that keeps trying to pigeonhole them. And they both don't enjoy that aspect. They both feel a bit misunderstood, but when they're together climbing, everything kind of makes sense. So it's a novel mostly about friendship and I guess being a misfit and finding your person who you can kind of talk to about anything. And it's important to have those friends in your life. So I think it's going to be a great pick for Book of the Month. Looking at my stack now, shall we move into the nonfiction? The nonfiction is quite
very cool. Yes, please keep us rolling.
I'll mention one more piece of fiction, which is Deborah Levy's latest novel, My Year in Paris with Gertrude Stein. If you love Deborah Levy, I think you're going to love this book. It's about someone who, you know, just goes looking for Gertrude Stein, obviously contemporaneous. So we're set in the right time. And it's just, you know, a great Levy experience and imagination. She just kind of went, oh, what would it be like trying to go and hang out with her? I'll write a book about it. And that's what she does. So if you're a big fan of modernism in Paris, I think you'll like My Year in Paris with Gertrude Stein.
Oh my goodness. How many of our listeners are big fans in modernism and Gertrude Stein? Please put a mention on our Instagram. We want to know.
I'm sure they're out there. Liddy's got quite a high hit ratio.
That's right.
Yes, sorry. Moving on to nonfiction. So in New Zealand, in Aotearoa nonfiction, we have some beautiful pictorial books. I wish we could sort of beam them through radio, but we can't do that. We had Aotearoa in Bloom.
Hold them up so I can see, though. Hold them up. Hold them up so I can see. Even if our listeners can't. Oh, my goodness. Gorgeous.
Yeah. The kaka pig on the cover, yeah. And this book is, it's by Rachel Clare and Tryphena Cracknell, Aotearoa in Bloom, published by HarperCollins. What I really like about it is that there's so much to know about plants. I think it's always a bit overwhelming when you kind of try to start identifying things and there are so many plants that look like so similar to each other at first. This book does a really beautiful job of breaking it down for the everyday person. So you won't need specialist gardener's knowledge or botanist's knowledge to be able to appreciate this book. It's got lovely plate drawings, which you probably would recognize if you had ever, you know, like how there's that big interior design trend of kind of embracing old school scientific plate drawings and illustrations, and they're all over wrapping paper and posters and things now. So you'll recognize that kind of style, but also you'll get a really lovely down-to-earth layman's history of the plant and what it's good for, what it did in Te Ao Māori, what it was used for. And I think they've just done a really good job of making it approachable. So many gardening books are just so sort of, whew.
Is it gardening? Is it gardening or just plant appreciation and plant knowledge? Does it talk about cultivation?
No, it's more about the history and culture and use of flowers. So specifically flowering plants. That's probably important to know. So you won't find everything in it.
Right.
Yeah. It's just very lovely to flick through. I think they've done a great job with that one. On the similar vein of beautiful pictorial things, we have The Secret Life of Fungi by Jay Lichter. Undoubtedly for fans of the Curious Foragers Field Guide by Liv Sisson, Fungi of Aotearoa. These books are quite different, though. So where Liv's book was a sort of handbook, this book is like a microscopic deep dive. So I'll show you so you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, my God. Close-up photographs. This is so interesting. We've had beautiful, there's so many new release beautiful books about both Aotearoa flowers and fungi. We've had a couple last year as well. So these are the ones to add to your library if you're into blooms and fungi in Aotearoa. Fantastic. Mm. And the title on that one was?
This is The Secret Life of Fungi by Jay Lichter.
Fabulous.
And it's got a beautiful pink mushroom on the front cover, so you can't miss it.
What are pink mushrooms good for?
Oh, these ones? Oh, I'm not sure, but they look pretty.
They look pretty. Exactly.
They're only like the height of my pinky finger or something like that. I'm sure it's tiny, but just the scale of photography that Jay's worked with, it's phenomenal. Into memoir now for fans. I mean, Elizabeth Knox has written many fantastic books. Nightmare is her memoir about a particularly turbulent period in her life. I just flipped through some chapters and it's very engrossing. So it's hard to put down.
Maureen's had a great chat with Elizabeth about that book as well, listeners. So, and it was a really valuable interview for me to listen to. I've got that one on my reading list. Can't wait. It's getting rave reviews.
Yeah. Just her way of writing about people is just is fascinating. I had a hard time putting it down. So that's doing quite well with us. We like it. Staff are enjoying it. Should we do international? We've got a bit of time.
Yes, indeed.
Lovely. So for us, the big special order numbers this month have been for London Fallen by Patrick Radden Keefe, no surprises, and Famesick by Lena Dunham. I'm going to start with London Falling. So this, if you're trying to find a book for somebody who loves to know things, maybe loves to be the person in the room who knows things and knows more than others, you're probably going to really, I think that person would probably enjoy reading Patrick Radden Keefe. His other books have been about, so there was Empire of Pain about the Sackler family and the opioid crisis in America. And there was Rogues, which was about sort of criminals and various sort of villains outside the law. And he writes so well, and is just really good at talking about the very terrible things people have done without kind of coming down too heavily on that and just like letting you kind of see it as it is and make up your own mind, you know. And London Falling is about the mysterious death of a teenager in 2019 in London, and the sort of criminal, it's a criminal underworld kind of story. So if you like Jared Savage, a New Zealand writer who writes on sort of organised crime, you'll also enjoy Patrick Radencliffe. I could be preaching to the choir here for all I know. I'm sure lots of the Plains listeners are already big fans of PRK, but I just wanted to give that one a wee boost.
Excellent. Thank you.
And then, yes, Lena Dunham, she will be known to many as the author of Not That Kind of Girl and the writer, producer, actor of Girls. And she's written a memoir about being famous. If you read the back, you might be inclined to roll your eyes a little bit. It sounds a little bit like, you know, a bit of a Rich Wah story. Maybe you're into that, because I think about the book, you know, I'm Glad My Mum Died by Jeanette McCurdy. And I think, oh, yeah, these stories can still be told in quite engaging ways. And there are aspects of fame that to me just seem so terrifying, and like I would just never want to have to deal with that in real life, you know? So I sort of get it, but I'm also a bit like, you know, don't know if I'll be that one.
Well, is that a generational thing as well? I think, you know, there's probably a group of women who grew up with girls, and I don't know. So Lena's got a kind of a special place in their psyche, and understanding how she fell apart under pressure, and what, you know, it's all part of the, I don't know, what's the kaleidoscope of fame, that we all find a bit addictive, isn't it? So yeah. Okay, so Lena Dunham. Yeah, excellent. And is that, have you done your whistle stop tour through your whole list?
I wanted to do one more, which was this great book. It's got a sort of naughty word in the title. It's Periodic Bitch by Emma Hardy. I picked up the reading copy for this because it just called to me. It's got this fantastic wolf sort of woman screaming on the cover. It's a memoir about PMDD, which is premenstrual dysphoria disorder, which is not very well understood and cyclical. And this memoir is the writer of this memoir just wanted to kind of lay it out there for people to just try and increase the understanding of PMDD and what goes on. But pretty much it's just like every 29 days, she goes crazy, you know, and she feels out of control. And then she starts to wonder why does this keep happening? And then just as suddenly the switch flicks and it's off again. And there's so much misinformation out there about PMDD and PMS. So
it just is occurring to me, and whether that's just the cover of the book, but do you think PMDD might be the kind of scientific explanation for werewolves?
It's a really good point.
anywho, something howling at the moon once a month, something like that. That's certainly how I felt. Claudia, thank you so much. And Scorpios, that's a fabulous list there. And we'll try and get a picture, photo of the stack on to put on our Insta when we run the show. Thank you very much. Ka kite anō.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Mihi. Ko te poho o tamatea te mauka. You stand above the village, bosom-like. You are a beauty. Your nipple formed from volcanic rock. Lava flowed like hot mama's milk. In 2011, when Ruai Moko turned again in the womb, a rock the size of a small car tumbled down your slope. That kōhatu gathered momentum as it rolled, and by the time it reached a dwelling on your lower slopes, its force was so great that it split a house in two. After this disaster, families from that side of the kaika had to relocate. Umbilical cut. Our whānau had moved away already half a century ago, so we were used to being estranged. Nonetheless, when I see you, I breathe easy. My shoulders relax. I am home. Ko whakaraupo te moana. My water ebbs and flows in you, amniotic fluid, waikahu. You are cloudy turquoise, surrounded by a dry crust, the Port Hills, nestled. So many times I've bathed in you, as a kid jumping from the wharf, scraping my skin on barnacles growing on the slippery wooden steps, droplets of blood released to the sea. Countless times I've stood on the main beach with mud squishing through my toes, hoping to avoid the nips of crabs. Lying in your saltiness is a cleansing inside and out, a holy communion. Ko Rāpaki te marae. Rāpaki is where my ancestors' bones crumble into the dry clay earth. Even if that taua did yell obscenities at my sister that time, telling us to fuck off back to Wainui, you don't own land here. That taua's bones now lie in the urupā alongside those of my tipuna. One day, mine will rest there too, forging us deeper into the whenua, stabilising. Our bones make us belong.
O tutahi poet Ariana Tikau, reading from her debut poetry collection, Pepehea Portal. I first met Ariana as a musician, but know her now as a writer of prose and poetry, as an interdisciplinary performer, and as an arts laureate. She has published a book before, Mokoroa, My Story of Moku Kauai. It was published in 2022. And Ariana, welcome. Haere mai.
Kia ora.
It's a treat to have you in the studio. As I say, you know, you've been in the studio before talking to my colleague Ruth as a musician and probably as a poet back then as well. But it was a surprise to me that this was your first poetry collection.
Yeah, I've really just gotten back into writing poetry after doing it as a young woman back in, you know, was in my early 20s, and then I think the music took over, you know, as I started getting into songwriting more and then Taonga Puoro, and yeah, so it was just really through doing the IIML course up in Wellington in 2022 that I started writing a hybrid collection, which included essays and poems. And then the year after, I was awarded the Ursula Bethel residency at the University of Canterbury. And my project for that was to do with this book, basically writing poems based on our local Māori place names here. And so, yeah, I was living up in Wellington at the time, and my husband Ross and I moved back, and our kids flew the nest around that time as well. So lots of change happening. But, It's been great to actually have something tangible that came out of that residency now.
Well, I'm very grateful that the residency brought you both back home.
Yeah.
Would you have come if you hadn't had that residency?
I think I've been wanting to come back for a while. Te Waipounamu really is home, and I love Wellington and the community there, but, yeah, the whenua itself is so, you know, important to me, so... Yeah.
It's beautiful to be back. And I mean, that comes through so, you know, well, it's there in just about all your poems, isn't it? That strong connection to your whenua. And the first part of it, Pepeha, is grounded in Banks Peninsula, in Rāpaki, in Whakarupo.
A lot of that
and
first
your family.
Half relates to the different ancestral stories and place names in particular as well, and the stories attached to those places.
In the book, there's a map.
Yeah.
Well, it begins, it's just a frontispiece, really, and that is one of your ancestors, isn't it?
In my tipuna, was Te One Tāre Tikau. He was my great-grandfather. And, this is a hand-drawn map of the Akaroa Harbour with a whole lot of Māori place names dotted right throughout it, even going out to the Heads and beyond. But also, yeah, I love that it's got some little drawings in the middle of the harbour with a whaling boat and a French ship, which he labels as Kaipuke Wiwi. So, yeah, it's got a lot of historical kōrero just in that one map as well.
And we've become so much more aware because of the work Kaitahu have done in reclaiming all those place names and putting them on. Well, it was a digital map to begin with, wasn't it?
And that's been a really great resource for me as well. As I was working on this collection during the residency, I photocopied pages from that digital atlas. Kahuru Manu is the name of it. And I've put little coloured pins in each of the places that I'd already written about just to keep a visual track of my my progress. So it was quite a fun thing to do.
Did the poems just build on each other, or did you have a clear idea about how you were going to structure the book?
I knew certain stories already that I wanted to write about, but also just research through that digital atlas and even just going out to places. That was a big part of the process as well. And just experiencing the places now and building on that relationship as well.
This is a Tikal Bay, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a poem in there about Tikal Bay and wanting to live there but not really being able to afford a batch there or whatever.
And one of my favourite places in Banks Peninsula is Birdlings Flat. It's Kaitoriti, the spit there. Because that is an incredibly atmospheric place to go to, isn't it?
Yeah, I love it out there as well. There's just so many special places to go to. And, yeah, I love how places can, well, I call them portals, I guess. They hold so many different layers of story and human experience, but also just the experience of kind of other than human life forms and entities, I suppose, as well, you might call them.
Yeah. There's a lot of political, I'm just going to, for want of a better word, say stuff in there because, you know, how can we not be affected by what's going on outside our immediate world? And poetry is such a powerful medium for expressing those thoughts and outrage and feelings and whatever.
In particular, there's a few poems in there relating to Gaza and what's been happening to the indigenous people there. And I couldn't help but write those stories into the book because I'm writing about what's happened to our tipuna, and was just feeling that so strongly as I was writing the collection. I've read some of those poems at fundraiser events and at the marches here around the time that I was writing them. So, yeah, I think it's really important to include them in the book as a record of that experience as well. You know, I think as writers, that's one thing that we can do. Like, sometimes it feels quite helpless. You know, what can we do? It's one outlet, I suppose, that we can express those feelings and hopefully, you know, give some solidarity as well.
Yeah. It's writers do it so much better than us non-writers, but us readers get to be affected by the words and, you know, relate so closely to them because you have the ability to capture those things and present them back to us.
I feel like it's a privilege really to be able to do that and share those thoughts and in these forms, and, you know, hopefully people will get something out of it.
I can't say anything other than, of course, stimulated, shamed at times, you're not trying to put the shame on us, but shamed at ignorance of things and then really engaged by learning about the places that I inhabit or I look at, I'm part of.
Yeah.
Knowing something about their history is, and in this form.
Yeah, I see it as an invitation, really, to experience the places in a new way, you know, and learn some of those stories, but, yeah, not in an overly didactic way, but just through emotion, really, and kind of a condensed form of the stories, or my interpretation of them.
Yeah, yeah, you were recently at the Akaroa Festival, Rawa, and you read one of the poems about one of your ancestors who leapt from the cliffs, and that told us a huge amount in such a relatively short poem. We learnt a huge amount about the place, the person, the times.
Yeah, that's Te Tararea Hikaiti, and I learnt about her story years and years ago. It was just a tiny paragraph in a whakapapa book about her, about how she had felt so heartbroken when her husband decided to marry her sister and take her sister on as a second wife. And, she objected, but, the one thing that I guess she could do was to, to leap off the cliff. But she, first of all, she adorned herself and, you know, dressed in her finest kākahu, you know, and it was kind of like a taking back of her mana in a way, which was really terrible. But I think it's important to know her story. And, her story actually, years later after reading it, came back to me in a dream. And in the dream I was writing a song about her story. So I felt like she was wanting her story to be told. Yeah.
Yeah, what a wonderful ability to be able to do that, to reach back and to ground her in the present as well as the past. Your use of te reo is, has always been there in your songs and your the performances you do, but it came about through hard work and total immersion, didn't it?
I've been learning for all my adult life, really, on and off. I don't know if I'll ever be fluent, but I can converse in te reo Māori. And, it's a really important part of my creative expression, particularly with singing, but also love reading in te reo Māori. And my husband Ross is a translator, so often he will translate some of my work, my poems in particular, and others have translated for me, just because I'm more fluent in English in terms of poetry is quite hard to write in language.
So this book isn't your first language. You've obviously worked with Ross, and
so he helped with some of the translations that are in there. They're not all translated. But recently, someone I don't know, a poet I don't know, translated one of the poems into te reo for me as a kind of koha back, and I suppose an exercise for him to honour the poem. Yeah. So that was really nice.
Yeah, it would be wonderful to see how he did it, how he laid it out, and how he... Because I imagine, two translators don't necessarily use the same words, do they?
And
they honour you, but they put...
He tried to write it in our dialect as well, so that was a really cool thing to receive.
Well, I really appreciate having so much reo in a book like this, because it gets integrated into the poem in such a easy manner that you don't need to provide translations all the time, do you?
So I've got notes which give a bit of context to the stories, and Kieran Fox, who was the MC at the launch, he said when he was reading it, he had the online dictionary open at Te Aka, and he said that added to the experience of looking up the meanings of some of the kupu words.
Well, I think that's the other thing I was going to say is that for people who are starting their project of becoming more fluent or, you know, being able to read te reo, books like this are such a great treasure for them, such, you know, a taonga, because it increases the amount of work that is out there and available to people in te reo.
Yeah, one of the poems that Ross translated for me was in my Mokorua book, so that made it into this collection as well. And I often like reading it in English first and then te reo Māori, if I'm performing it, just so that people already have that meaning and then they can just kind of listen to the flow of the reo in it.
I think we should close with a poem.
Okay, so this is Te Tārere Ahikaiti. I fell for you, muscled breath, love-bit skin in my prime. Muscled breath like good wine in my prime, steeped in terroir. Like good wine juiced and crushed, steeped in terroir, I leapt to my death. E rere e hine I tēnei pari e, whana ki te hau o raka whenua e. Juiced and crushed, fermented heart, I leapt to my death. I sang my lament. E pupu ake, māu e tito e waiata e, ko te tārere a hika I ti e. Fermented heart, love bit skin, I sang my lament. I fell for you.
Ngā mihi nui, Ariana, for this beautiful collection of poems. It's called Pepeha Portal. It's by Ariana Tikau, and it's published by Otago University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Claude Megson is a familiar name to me, having had an architect husband who studied under him at the Auckland School of Architecture in the late 60s. Claude's work was described as experimental and at times fantastical. He was an inspiring teacher, but he also had the ability to alienate some with his strong personality. His life and work were tragically cut short by his death in 1994, but now a handsome and appropriately well-crafted book has been published to celebrate and reclaim his legacy. Unfortunately, the author, architect Charles Reed, lives and works in London, but fortunately I'm joined by photographer Jackie Mayring, whose work more than complements the text. Jackie is specialised in photographing architectural works and has an impressive catalogue of works published in both magazines and books. Jackie, before we talk about Claude, maybe we should, it's appropriate to talk about Giles and his love and a respect for Claude's work.
Yes. Well, he, you know, phoned me out of the blue over 10 years ago, introducing himself and wanting me to possibly work towards a smaller book. And that I had heard of Claude before. A friend owned one of his Harpur Street developments. And so I'd been inside one, but I wasn't aware of his body of work or him as an architect. I am from South Africa. You might pick up the accent, but, you know, been here a little while. So it was a good time to get my teeth into one architect's work. And Giles, you know, invited me on this journey, which has been wonderful. So Giles had been taught by Claude. He's an independent architect working out of London, Kiwi born. And, you know, he just really felt there was a missing catalogue, story, imagery, you know, of Claude's work, and that he was an important architect in New Zealand's history. And, yeah, so we embarked on the journey together.
And what a journey, because while there are an impressive amount of drawings in archives,
yes.
Finding the houses and the and other buildings was more difficult because some have been demolished, some have been changed by yes. people renovating them, obviously, over the years. So trying to find the works that were still sort of essentially Claude Megson's works was not as easy as it sounds by the...
And Giles, you know, was well positioned, having been taught by him, being an architect, being a Kiwi, and being in that fraternity, he had an incredible network. And he was just from London.
Yeah.
he was just alerted to what was for sale, what was potentially up for demolition. And then as we gathered steam, he really wanted every worthwhile Megson recorded as much as possible. I mean, there were owners who were reluctant to have photography in their homes. But, you know, he would send me forth and I would try my best to, you know, because I'm arriving, I'm sort of, you know, I can front face his desire to get these houses photographed. And it all came from a really positive perspective. And so that's how we started.
Yeah, wonderful. A wonderful project to have. I first saw a Claude Megson house. I don't know whether it would have been the same Harpur Street one, but when I was at university in Auckland, you know, I had this architect boyfriend who I later married, but it wasn't through him. It was through a girl who I met, and her parents lived in one of those Harpur Street townhouses, one of the earliest ones, and I went in there only once, and I think it's probably the first, you know, experience for me of going into a proper architectural space, a house that had been thought out and thought through and had lovely things in it.
Yes.
So I have a strong memory of that.
It might have been the Rees townhouses or the Merkisich.
I think it was the Merkisich.
Okay.
Yeah, because of
they were smaller.
Yeah, and they were right at the end in my memory of Harpur Street.
Yes.
But I have a strong memory of the space and the light and the way the spaces were organised. Because Claude, he was very, he worked in a different way from a lot of architects because he had this sort of really strong philosophy of how you should put houses together. So his clients really needed to go along with him, didn't they?
Yes. And, you know, the kind of clients who were attracting, there were some artists like Roy Good, there were collectors of art, there were people who just appreciated design. They would have to give him free rein because this is my understanding through Giles, and because he did like to have full control and he had a very strong philosophy. I mean, when you enter a Megson home, you're in no doubt that it's been designed down to the step that you're on and then the entrance. And it's sort of, you are directed and through the experience of the home. It isn't a front door and then, you know, a box. It is really understood upon entry. It is a discovery, and which makes it photographically obviously very exciting, but also hard to explain. But that was the journey, it seemed, that his clients, you know, they bought into his philosophy, and then he, you know, he just looked at the site and went quite fast into the whole process. I mean, I can't speak too much about the architectural side.
How you recorded it. He was a meticulous draftsman because, you know, he'd been brought up and done his apprenticeship with Gummer and Ford, old Auckland firm, but yes. His drawings were immaculate, weren't they?
Absolutely beautiful. And we've actually got in the book, Rees Townhouse, I think we've got two, where I photographed exactly as the drawing, and this is hand drawing, so perspectival hand drawing, and I could match that with the image in both the kitchen. And this is after there've been a few improvements and, you know, and it's slightly differently occupied. It really, his vision is still there. But those are the owners who really, who buy and appreciate and who don't want to, they don't want to change. They're just sort of modernizing maybe a little or dealing with, you know, some waterproofing issues, which were definitely a problem if they're very complex roof lines. And it's amazing, those drawings. I actually went into the archives and photographed a lot of them. There were two big, Sarah Cox, who was at an Auckland University looking after these Megson drawings, had to take them across the road and then scan them. And in the rain and the wind, some of them were just too fragile. So we set up a mini studio and they're wonderful. And this is the other thing about the book, is just having those drawings of projects that never got built alongside projects that were, just from an architect's perspective as well, but also from an art perspective. They are truly beautiful.
They are. He was very influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright, wasn't he, amongst the other modernist. The book, Giles, focuses on Claude the architect rather than Claude the man, but he can't help but describe him. And apparently he wore a cloak at one stage, like Frank Lloyd Wright did.
Yes. He must have cut quite a dashing figure around the university, because he also lectured. In fact, he began lecturing the year I was born, which is sort of kind of interesting little parallel.
Yes.
And I'm not young. Giles was telling me, and I think he's shared it in the book, about how he'd have a dual presentation lecture with slides going and sometimes even music. He did believe in engaging all the senses, and you get that sense in his houses as well, in the way he includes the landscape and the garden. And you know, it's the house doesn't end where the garden starts. They sort of have a symbiosis, which is another lovely thing to shoot. So very interesting from that perspective as well, that inside-outside flow, ahead of his time, I think.
Yes, and a lot of those places that are still, you know, pretty pure Megson houses and gardens, the landscape must, you know, now be very much grown up and matured and really add to the experience of being there.
Yes. That is something I did sort of realise, just the Wood Street townhouses. I didn't come across one in particular, maybe up north in Whangarei, Hill and Bauka, but where the landscape had been improved over time and had hit a sweet spot. The architecture was still dominated, and I wonder, you know, certain trees had obviously matured, but there were, his gardens were often partitioned and there were sort of concrete walls and paths and less, you know, in a sort of a fluid way, a little more controlled, but still very intentional.
Yes, the way he drew and placed chairs, artworks, tables, all the furnishings of the house. And quite often, according to Giles, the clients went and bought the chairs that he had drawn in. You know, they'd all be famous, well-known chairs like Eames chairs or Corbusier chairs or Arne Jacobson chairs, but there they'd be in the drawings. Exactly where
they
Claude
should be.
Yes, exactly.
And he was even known anecdotally to have a key and show students around while homeowners were away, and even rearrange furniture back to the way he liked it. So they'd come back to the Claude treatment. Which is fascinating. So I think that ownership is really, really quite striking. That feeds sense of kind of birthing a design and the personal connection to the houses that he designed and then, you know, got to see to fruition. And yeah, just incredible that he felt he could still have access, but also says something about the relationship he had with his clients. And I got to meet quite a few original clients, and some of them, sadly, in these 10 years of shooting have passed.
Yeah.
The bars Finola Cocker. But they all spoke very affectionately of Claude, you know, so despite, you know, him being a bit polarizing, he clearly also, you know, had a fan base.
He surely did.
People who appreciated him.
Well, you and Giles have done a magnificent job in recording his work and giving him the honours that he so well deserves. And
thank you.
And, you know, it is really important that an architect of his calibre have a book of this calibre. Massey University Press have done such a splendid job, as they always do.
Yeah.
It's a joy to own it. So thank you, Jackie, for your time.
Great pleasure. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
The book is called Claude Megson, Architect. The text is by Giles Reid, the photographs by Jackie Mayring, and it's published by Massey University Press. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.